When you have to stop but don't really want to, stop at BP. Because BP has everything you need to keep it going. Fuel to keep the adventures going. The BP Me app to keep the savings and the commutes going. Snacks and drinks to keep the crew going. And the BP Me Rewards Visa to keep the rewards going and going and going. A stop at BP isn't a stop at all. Keep it going.
This is your typical radio ad while eating a Crunch Bar.
This is Automatic of Otto's Used Cars. This weekend only, we're having a whale. Bring the kids. See for yourself. It is huge. Gonna make a big splash. No other dealer can say they have a whale like this.
When things sound dull, turn up the fun with Crunch.
Hey, Holly.
Hey, Dave.
Holly, welcome to the What Difference Does It Make podcast. We're a proud member of the Pantheon podcast family. We're celebrating the chaos with a documentary that just came out called Long Live Rock, and we have some special guests today. Who we have?
We do. This is so awesome. We have Gary Spivak, who is the producer, Jonathan McHugh, the director, and we have RJ Hale, the drummer from the band Hailstorm.
And the film is called Long Live Rock, Celebrate the Chaos.
This is so awesome getting to talk about this film.
You're going to love this episode. In case you didn't know why you're here today, remember going to rock festivals? Remember when we went to a rock festival, Holly?
Went to a rock festival. That might have been one of the last shows we saw.
Well, it was the last rock festival I saw. And that's, yeah. I mean, it's fun. There were a lot of bands we never heard of. It was a community because you knew everyone in there were fans of The Cure. And Robert Smith was a fan of all these other bands, so we were gonna love these bands, and that's kind of what, you know, rock festivals are. It's just a shared community of people who love music and love getting together with people of like minds. We're gonna talk with Jonathan McHugh, the director, Gary Spivak, producer, RJ Hale, drummer for Hailstorm. Let's get right into it now.
Hello.
Good morning.
Hey, good morning, everybody.
Hey, good morning. Welcome to the morning zoo.
Hi.
Ding, ding.
My God, thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. It's very nice to see you guys. Thanks for being, are you all in LA? This is pretty early.
I'm in Santa Monica. Gary's in the Palisades. AJ, where are you?
I'm in Nashville.
Nashville.
Oh, okay.
So it's not that early. Not too bad. Hey, at this point, it's just nice to see anybody.
I understand. I know.
People.
Yeah.
RJ was a SoCal boy until recently, though, right?
I moved to LA in like 2012 just because I loved it out there. We made our first two records out there, and I always wanted to live there. So when I got the chance, I was like, this is where I'm going to move to. I'm going to live here. and I still live there part-time, but now the band is based out of Nashville, so it makes sense that we have everything kind of central located here.
Okay, I got to know, what was the impetus for this film, and whose was it?
My name is Jonathan, the director of the film, Jonathan McHugh. Gary and I have known each other since we worked with Metallica at Elektra Records in the early 90s. Always been a fan of the genre, grew up in the genre. Cut to Gary becoming one of the biggest hard rock festival booker promoters in the country. He was working on a festival in Columbus, Ohio, and I had pitched him on the idea. I said, Gary, you know, the fandom of this community is so interesting, and Gary had been trying to get me to come out to some of these Midwestern festivals for a while, never made it out. He goes, McHugh, we booked Metallica, 10th anniversary of this festival. Why don't you come out? And why don't we shoot some stuff? And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, come on, man. Well, you wanted to make a movie about the genre, right? I was like, yeah. He goes, well, let's figure it out. And Gary, being a very can-do guy, and me being a very can-do guy, we basically got some crew members together from local. We brought my cinematographer from L.A., and we went to Columbus, and Gary lined up interviews with some heavy hitters, and we shot interviews with them. And then Gary found us some really interesting fans who were really passionate about the genre and met up every year at these festivals. We just shot a sizzle reel, and it was pretty good. There was a lot of great stuff there. And so we pitched it to a company that I had been doing, directing a documentary about the Comic-Con cosplay culture, the transformative nature of that genre and that fan base, I should say. And so they said, well, what else are you doing? I said, well, I'm interested in this other fan base, this hard rock fan base, because they're incredibly passionate. And we cut that sizzle reel together, and they gave us a little bit of money. And then we found some private money, and we just kind of kept rolling, you know, years later, right, Gary?
many years later. It takes a village to put these things on. Yeah, I think what I wasn't interested in doing was just kind of filming a live concert. You know, when we booked Metallica and we got Lars, and the second big interview we got, not to kind of to go from first to third gear here, the second big interview we got was Chris Cornell. And so we had Lars and Chris Cornell lined up at this festival called Rock on the Range in Columbus, Ohio. And then the day before we began shooting, Chris passed took his life. And like documentaries do, because they're unscripted, this began a new story arc, a big one, into the loss of such an important artist. And then a couple months after that, Chester Bennington passed too. So we had to go deep dive into, okay, besides the fandom and the celebration of rock and roll and the live experience, there's another side to this and how music can be a healing force, but also how dependency and depression is so a big part of music and an artist and the demons that they face. Fans too, humans.
Yeah.
And this beloved but often misunderstood genre of hard rock really brings people together. And it really makes this whacked out, dysfunctional, beautiful family that we all see. I mean, RJ and I have known each other from the time his band played the Jägermeister stage at noon.
That's right.
In 2000, many years ago.
Yeah.
And when we get to it, I have a very funny story, RJ, that I just remembered as I was dialing into this for you and I, that was and when the time is right to hopefully bring it up on this.
Oh, no.
Not for public consumption.
No.
Yeah. So when John and I, you know, started filming and got the film crew, and like he said, really just like with scotch tape and glue and heart and soul, these stories started developing. We started finding this common thread, this theme of family and unity and community that this music and this genre brings together.
Actually, that was the words I kept hearing over and over in this film, just describing the fans. It's a tribe, sense of community, party crew, family, respectful. These were words that kept popping up in this film. I mean, Holly and I were just talking that it's a love letter to the fans. Like it's, you know, this is something that people look forward to, and it means the world to them, to, you know, not just the music, but the community.
Yeah, I'll jump in, you know, now that I'm older and, you know, as a kid, I went to see Zeppelin, I went to see Kiss, I went to see Black Sabbath, and they were seminal moments for me in my life and my crew, that we were rock kids. There was nothing else. There was no other kind of music. You know, there may have been disco, but that wasn't our stuff, you know. And pop music. But so growing up as a rock fan, you know, we would go to these shows and it would be some of the biggest nights of our lives, right? So cut to, you know, today in your 40s and 50s, and I went to Tulane University and my crew was all Grateful Dead type people, and so we meet up at festivals all across the country. We meet Jazz Fest every year in New Orleans, you know, because we love New Orleans music. And that is a culture unto itself, you know. And then you take it to this level of fandom where people crowd surf and they mosh and they just let it all out and they headbang. And they're off-putting in the sense the visual is off-putting. Some people don't like tattoos. Some people don't like piercing. Some people don't like long hair. Some people don't like screeching guitars. And so the genre gets a bad name, but when you meet these people and hang with them, they're just like normal right. fucking people like you and me. So it's also another theme for me is you can't judge a book by its cover.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's really a fascinating thing to get into all this music and to meet people like AJ and Lizzie and hear their stories coming from Red Lion, Pennsylvania. And they were both so great in the film that, you know, you just want to shoot more. So, for example, I asked Gary, hey, can we, you know, talk to McBill and McGathy? And, like, you know, they're playing a show with two other female rock bands. Like, why, let me go up to the Warfield and shoot with them. And then Lizzie let me come to her record signing at Amoeba and you know, interviewed AJ on the bus. And it's like you dive deep with these people and it's just – it warms your heart that these people are out there every day on the bus playing for these fans and just doing their life is on the road, making music, playing music. And it's, you know, it's everything as a rock fan you want to be around. And as a guy in the business for so many years, it was just really refreshing to get back to it for me.
It's great.
You did put a really nice face on the fan on that community, because it does get a bad rap. But I mean, it also, you commented about the Amoeba signing. That was what it was, Amoeba that was on camera with Lizzie, yeah, and you guys.
One of the last record stores in the world. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, geez. It was nice to see. It was really great to see the interaction between the band and the fans.
Oh, yeah. That girl who had saved herself, like in virgin context, of going to see, to make her first show, Hailstorm. Because of what Lizzie Hale meant to her, mm-hmm. in a female-fronted rock band. And I just kind of was, I mean, I wasn't surprised by it, because it, in coming of age of kids in music, but she picked Lizzie as that idol in a way. And when she got to meet her and my camera was there, I was like, I got, you know, chills. Yeah. Because watching that interaction, how cool Lizzie was, how the moment meant something, and the fact that you can capture that as a documentarian, you know, it doesn't have to be all, you know, refugees and the emotional nature of things. It's a simple human interaction piece, and that's what we caught in that moment,
yeah.
You know.
RJ, do you like doing these? Do you like the signings and like meet and greets?
Yeah, especially at a place like Amoeba, which I've been to the one in LA a bunch of times. I've never been to the one in San Francisco. So that was really cool to get to see that. And you're right. It is kind of like the last of the record stores, you know. It's still standing, and I'm glad it's still there. We had a scare. We were like, oh no, I hope Amoeba doesn't go away, because it's so cool. But they were so cool too, because they every time we go and do a signing for Amoeba, they always give us a bunch of store credit to go and get a bunch of records for ourselves. And so that was really cool.
Reason alone to do it.
But yeah, I loved that show in San Francisco, particularly because I feel like we don't play a lot in California. And California is where a lot of great rock and roll music came from. So it's cool to see that we were able to play in San Francisco, and the show was able to sell so well. And you're right, it was a stacked female-fronted rock band lineup. I feel like that's a pretty cool thing that has changed about the heavier music genres, is seeing not only more female-fronted or bands with females in them, but also the fans that come out. You're seeing a lot of a lot more female rock fans out there, which is great. When we started, it was us, Flyleaf, and Evanescence. That was pretty much it. And now you got like Stitched Up Heart, New Year's Day, Diamante, Sick Puppies with Emma in this moment. And so it's great to see that. You're right, it's great to see more representation in the genre. Yeah.
And you know, also as a fan, for me, I now that I think about it, like, I was always assuming that this genre is primarily the sausage fest, where it's all male, it's all white. And so by going to these shows and getting there early and watching the bands that were starting early and seeing these bands, and my wife, who also worked in the festival business, would be like, she'd be like, call me up and say, hey, you got to come over to the stage. There's this band called In This Moment playing, and this woman's amazing. She's like a theatrical performer. And like, my wife, I don't want to say hates this music, but she doesn't like the hard music, you know? But yet, if there was a female in it, she was in it. Yeah. And it's just interesting to see. So in the movie, when we started to get into it, and you meet, you know, Lizzie Hale, and you met Maria, and you meet Dorothy, and you're like, and then all of a sudden you see, obviously, you know, Tom Morello, but AJ from Fire From the Gods. And
yes, I love that band.
And Jason and Steve from Fever 333, and that there's minorities represented in the genre. And it's like, oh, okay, so I can help tell the story that it's not just this, it's also this. Now, it's mostly this, but the fact that it's becoming more this is amazing. And so that was something for me as a fan of the genre, and my also misconceptions, because I hadn't been part of it for so long. But Gary's living it every day. He's booking these bands. He's finding these new bands that are coming in and representing different cultures into the game. So that was kind of an awakening for me also, and I'm glad we got to show some of that.
Great point, though, because you're right. Like, bringing people who look like them, or having artists that look like and represent like the audience is important, you know, because you're right. It is mostly one thing. And then if you're a different color, different sexual orientation or different gender, then you're like, okay, nobody looks like me up there. Like, I can't really connect with that. And that's really why I'm glad you mentioned like Fever 333, Fire From the Gods, all these great rock bands that are diversifying rock music. And I think that's vital. I think that's really important.
Sure.
Yeah. One of the nice things about this movie is you kind of touched on not only women, but people of color and even the security, which never gets mentioned in a rock festival, but it's a huge part of it.
Yeah, Dave, so that was one of the most interesting things in the whole thing for me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, get there, you're thinking bands, fans, right? Yeah. And all of a sudden you see how security has to work, because the crowd surfing at these Midwestern festivals is like nothing you've ever seen.
Right.
And the fact that these guys have this almost ballet routine where one guy is held up by the other guy and the other guy catches and the other guy pushes the feet away so they don't get kicked in the head. Then he turns and he lets the other guy hold the body, and they put the body down and they go and do it. And as I think it was Noodles from Offspring, or one of the guys from Offspring, said, you know, it's kind of like this ride at Disneyland. Like, these are the guys that get you out of this intense ride after you've been crowd surfing from the back to the front, just so you could get a thumbs up from the rock star, hopefully. And you've kind of risked your life doing it. You fall on your head, you know, it's not a good look. So the security guys, and then when Gary introduced me to Seth, the head of security, and he's like, yeah, my secret, I hire a football team. Offensive line, defensive line of these football teams. Why? Because they all work together, these college football teams in this local market, and they all know each other, and they have to back each other up. And it's just like in any sort of sport, you have to be working as a team to win. So that thing was eye-opening for me, and I was like, I want to make this a segment. I had no idea how, but we just got great people, and they were wonderful to talk to.
Oh, you captured it really well, the football team and the teamwork that it takes, but also just the security in general and how it works. And all I could think about at the end was how exhausted they must be just bringing down person after person.
It's a workout. And, you know, for me as a kid, you think of security like you're always at a show where I went to Madison Square Garden. You're always trying to sneak down, get better seats. You're smoking weed. You know, you're bringing in people. You're bringing in your friends to sit in your seats with you. And security was like the adversary. You know, you were like against them. Now it's like, oh, this is like a team. They have to work between the bands and the fans to build this connection so there's no bad karma between the barriers, if you will. And that was another really eye-opening thing for me as a fan and a documentarian.
I am curious, though, about the fans. How did you find that? You said, Gary, you found the fans. But how did you – I mean, you must have drawn from a bigger pool.
The story of that is they started a MySpace page back in the day. And they called them the Party Crew. And they would contact me and some other people at my company. And they would deliver us T-shirts, really ugly weird colored T-shirts every year with our names on it, and it got more elaborate. These people, instead of, you know, going to Cancun or Hawaii or bungee jumping or whatever, they went to these festivals. That was their vacation. That was their getaway. That's what they spent their hardworking money on, and they just let loose. And we wanted to explore, and, you know, found one of them, nurse by day, crowd surfer by night, you know, police officer by day, partier at rock festivals by night. And we just thought that needs to be explored. You know, it's one thing to have RJ and Lizzie and you know, Duff and Lars and Tom Morello talk about rock and roll.
Yeah.
I think it's another thing to really hear it from the people that are taking out their wallets to go see Hailstorm and why.
Dude, we'll have tours where people will go to every single show. They're like, this is our vacation. We're just touring right along with you. We're just driving to every city. And we're like, how do you afford this? And there's so many mysteries. Like, what do you do for a living? And how do you afford all this? And the other thing is the cruise, the Shiprock cruise, is where people pay top dollar to not only see their bands on a boat, but hang out with them and go to breakfast with them. And it's like, that's a whole other level of like the most hardcore of hardcore fans right there.
I got to ask, is there a little bit of a fishbowl? Is it a little too whacked out? You walk out of your hotel, your ship deck, and like, hey, dude, you want to play paddle board?
You know what? Long story short, I have heard from a lot of bands before we even did Shiprock, a lot of them saying it's a nightmare. It's terrible. Like, oh, we hate it. We can't go anywhere without getting accosted. And then I heard from some of my really good friends. In fact, I will drop this name. LaJean from Seven Dust is one of the guys that sat me down because I was like, we're about to go on Shiprock. Could you please tell, like, prepare me? He's like, dude, every single time I go out of my room and I have a chance to interact with the fans, that is a chance that I get to make their entire life. I get to make that. I get to make them feel so good, and they're diehard fans for life. It takes only like 60 seconds, mm-hmm. not even that,
right.
to make a fan for life. And so that really prepared me, because I heard a lot of fans come up to me and say like, wow, thanks for being so cool. I ran into some other bands and this other guy, and I think he was having a bad day, and I don't know. I was just like, I don't want people talking about me like that to other people. So I went into it nose first, and I was like, let's just fully commit. It's 5 days. I'm going to take a selfie with everybody. I'm going to do everything I can to make it a special experience. And it actually ended up being so fun and rewarding for me. Like, actually going into it with the mission statement of like, I'm going to make this a full experience for these fans. Like, they're not only are they going to get to like meet me and say hi, but like, we're going to play games. We're going to do shots. We're going to do all kinds of fun stuff. And it ended up being a blast. I actually really loved it.
All right. We're talking with Gary Spivak, Jonathan McHugh, and RJ Hale of Hailstorm. And we are going to take a break and be right back.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things KISS. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Welcome back to the What Difference Does It Make podcast and our chat about the new documentary, Long Live Rock, Celebrate the Chaos.
Can I ask RJ a question?
Yes, please.
Please. It's an open forum here.
Does Hailstorm, do you prepare yourself differently when you play in front of 1,500 people or 40,000 people? Or is it like same show?
No, that's actually a really good question. Maybe it just goes back to like doing it for so many years in front of like, you know, like my sister and I, we played shows where it was just like me, her, and the sound guy. And our bandmates, but like basically the band, and like we're playing for the sound guy, and we didn't care. We were just like, hey guys, we're playing a gig. This is so cool. And we really never lost that, you know, like whether we play at the machine shop or whether we play at Sonic Temp, at a big festival or, you know, whatever. No, it's the same show. And that we've always strived for that. Like we always warm up the same. We always, you know, make sure that we're healthy, we're warmed up, we're stretched, we're good to go out there and slay it. And that's what it takes. Like you really need to think of every gig as your last gig, you know, like this could be it, you know? And I think we've always felt that way because we've been through so many milestones where we're like, oh man, like we're going to get dropped tomorrow or our record's going to get shelled. Like, you know, so many, the fact that the stars align so well for us, like we don't take it for granted. You know, we can't, because we've had so many near misses where like our career could have poof, like been gone before anyone even knew who we were. So no, you got to put the same effort into every show.
Can I get a question now? Is it my turn?
Always.
Please.
Thank you for raising your hand.
We have not spoke since you did the cover of the Who classic Long Live Rock.
That's right.
There was a drummer on that original record named Keith Moon. So,
oh, that guy.
I want to talk to you about making that record, how it felt for you. Were you a fan of that song? And oh, by the way, you killed it. Thank you very much.
Oh, thanks, man. I actually never heard that Who song until that request. I've been a huge Who fan from the beginning, I was raised on that. I was raised on Keith Moon and John Bonham and all those guys. And that was the first song that we cut when we like shook the dust off after 2020 of doing nothing and then went in the studio and started. We're like, okay, we're wearing masks. We're in the studio. It's a big studio. We're socially distancing. It's just the four of us and our producer and starting to get back into it, trying to write songs, record songs. And we were like, let's ease back into this. Let's start with this cover. And basically, after not playing for several months and going in the studio and just channeling my inner Keith Moon, like it was really fun. and it was a really great way to kind of kick off our return to the studio to write and track songs and stuff. Long live life. Down at the Astoria, the scene was changing.
Thank you for doing that.
Amazing. I appreciate that, man. It was a lot of fun. Any chance to be able to play Keith Moon
today through Loudwire magazine? The song is now out through Loudwire magazine. So if you want to,
I was going to say, when will we get to hear it?
Yeah, right.
It's a ripper. It's a total. You guys turned this iconic song into this 2021 modern rock banger.
Thanks, man.
Very cool.
You know, I will tell you. And for those who don't know, he is a badass motherfucking drummer. He is vicious. I've said
real funny.
That's the third thing I was
going
to talk
to. Is this
about
the morning zoo? What are you doing here, RJ? What's going on?
I bring my own sound effects. Sorry, yeah.
He does stand up comedy, everybody. We got to get to that in a minute. But I've personally told Dave Grohl and Taylor Hawkins, like, have you watched or seen RJ Hale of Hailstorm? Please go see him, because I know Dave Grohl will be like, dude, fucking sickest drummer around, because he's fantastic. He is.
Wow.
He's Tommy Lee meets Keith Moon. I am very busy at festivals, and I make a point of seeing Hailstorm every time, and I'm side of stage just watching him. Like, I have iPhone footage of just him.
Like, I'm Gary!
So.
No, it was fun at the Warfield show. Standing on stage, you know, where it was intimate. You couldn't really get close on the big festivals. But watching him on the on the Warfield stage was really impressive to just be up close to that shit. So props to you, young fella.
Thank you guys so much. That really means a lot.
But he does stand-up comedy too, y'all.
No.
I was going to say, you're pretty, you know, usually the drummer hangs back. We know a lot. They hang back. They're on the more on the quieter side, some. But, I mean, personality-wise, you have a full-on, you have a great voice, too. I mean, you have a really nice voice, too.
Thank you. So do you.
So, thank you. So where can we see you do stand-up?
You know, it's kind of sad. I wanted to get into it while we were on break in 2020, like while we were kind of in between writing and recording out here in Nashville, because one of my, actually my bass player's neighbor, who's a friend of ours, kind of talked me into doing a tight five at this open mic night at the East Room over here in Nashville. And it was really fun. It was a blast. And I didn't really expect anything from it, but like my guitar player videotaped the whole thing and he sent it to like all these people, and it got to Gary and it got to Danny and the whole crew. And they were just like, and now Sonic Temple's doing a stand-up stage, which you guys have had the great Jim Brewer perform at, which I love Jim Brewer. And we were just talking after our show there, after when we played on the same night as System of a Down, and they were like, you know, next year we should do you should get up and do a stand-up set. I was like, I will definitely do a stand-up set next time that we're booked for this festival. You have my word. I'll get up and do it.
And he does, I think after doing bad jokes, he will do your rim shot.
I do my own rim shots.
Nice.
The more grown worthy, the better.
Can I go back, RJ, to when you were a kid? I mean, you grew up, we mentioned Red Lion, Pennsylvania. I looked it up, population 6,300. Where did you go to shows? Where did you go record shopping? What radio station did you listen to? It's a small town, so you probably, you had probably a small crew of friends. And
well, when we were like really young kids, our parents took us to a lot of festivals. They would we would travel to go see like some of the festivals, you know, festival shows and stuff like that. We saw a lot of cool bands.
Where was the big city?
Oh gosh. I mean, not a lot of cities. There was like a festival that set up at like a farm somewhere in like central PA.
Yeah.
I think North Central PA. And it was maybe like an hour drive or something. And we'd go there, we'd go camping, and it was like a 5-day festival or something like that, you know, which is like, when we go to play festivals and we see people camping in tents and stuff, we're like, oh, memories. But in when we started gigging and playing shows, a lot of times we would just love to go see the other local bands in the community. Like, cause you're right. Like the nearest city to us was probably Philadelphia, which is like 2 hours, and Baltimore was like maybe like an hour and a half. New York was like 4 hours away. So we didn't really get a chance to go out to see shows that we weren't already performing, we weren't already playing at, because we were doing a lot of shows. But we really liked the whole local community in Central PA, and I think that I think the fact that we started in kind of a small pond really wasn't a lot of other things going on there. It kind of made it easy for us to build up a following, and that I think was a huge help with us getting noticed.
Where'd you guys play? What
I would play bars and you know stuff like that, like dive bars and stuff like that, and then we were working with this producer, and we started showcasing in New York, and we were like, well, we don't have an audience in New York. So what we would do is we would just like rent a van and take a whole bunch of our fan friends that we had in Pennsylvania and just drive them up to New York. So we'd have like a little bit of a crowd.
Smart.
And it really helped, you know, it really helped. And people started seeing the numbers that we were raking in Pennsylvania. Like, oh, wow, these guys are playing just this bar, but they're packing out these bars in Central PA. Like, you know, it really helped us kind of get noticed.
Was this like, you started out in, is the mid-90s or early aughts? What's
97 was when we started. I was like, yeah, 10
so,
years old. Yeah.
So it really wasn't social media. What were,
nope.
How'd you, what was your promotion secret? What, how'd you get the word out besides friends?
We'd go to Staples or Office Max and print up a bunch of really cheap flyers. And we would go to gas stations and grocery stores and and put them there. And sometimes we would just secretly like stick them like in the bathroom, like when no one was looking, and hope that enough people see it before the staff like take it down. And like, it was a lot. Yeah, you're right. It was a totally different world now. And nowadays newer bands have at their fingertips, like this online way to self-promote. And it's actually really great. It's bringing a lot of independence and power to independent artists. I think the disadvantage is that there's so much more competition now because there's so much more traffic. You know, it's kind of the equivalent of like putting a flyer up on a billboard with like, you know, 100 other flyers. Like, how is yours going to stand out? And we would try to make them colorful and, you know, try to think of ways. So there's more opportunities, but also I think the same principle hasn't changed.
Yeah.
Where like, well, basically, you know, like what Don Henley said in that Eagles documentary, crap don't float, you know, you still have to be good. It doesn't matter how many shiny objects you have to your advantage. Like if the core of the music isn't really good, then it's, you know, probably not going to do very well.
You have to back it up.
Yeah.
Exactly. You have to back it up. Yeah.
But that probably touches on the fest. There's still competition when you're playing festivals. You're kind of an opening band. I'm sure you're looking at the bill going, oh my God, we got to follow these guys, or we're playing at the same time as these guys. We got to, you know, is it a competition? Do you feel like it's a battle of the bands when you're up there?
It's a little bit of a friendly competition, especially in the early days. Now it's like when we go to play a festival, people already know what to expect and we're able to just deliver. We still want to give them a great show. But in the beginning, you're right. It was like we had no production. We were playing in the daytime and there's no light show. There's no nothing. So we're like, we have to be the production. We have to like exert. We have to make the first move as far as exerting energy. The crowd is not going to respond unless we start it, you know, and that's always kind of been our mission objective every time we go on stage. And that really hasn't changed at all. But especially in the beginning, that you're right. Like other bands that would play, we'd be like, oh man, we really got to up our game. You know, we always felt that way. Like we can't just phone it in. Like we got to up our game. And that's kind of stuck with us.
That's kind of the cool thing about festivals, though. Even when you're an opener, you already have a fan base there that wants to like you. When you go to a festival, you want to like everybody you're going to see, you know, all the bands you're going to see, and maybe get exposed to something new.
It's tough though, like when you're the first band on the bill and it's like 11 a.m. and people are just starting to walk in. Like we've played plenty of those festivals, we relived it several years later when we started doing Europe festivals, and we're like, oh, we're starting all over again. Like nobody knows who we are, and that just kind of pushes you to want to really up your game. Because like we really got to make an impression on these people, and that's what it takes. We've always kind of had our live show has always kind of been our bread and butter.
Do you find there's a difference between U.S. and Europe audiences, or down in South America, or where? You know, South America always has like the reputation of an intense, like real intense fans.
You're exactly right. Yeah. Like in different regions of the world, they do react differently, but they're all special in their own way. One thing I like about, you're right, South America and European festivals is like when you start the kick drum, everyone starts going like this. Ay. And that's really cool. But not to take anything away from the U.S. audiences, because it's funny to see different crowds in different regions of the world react differently to certain moments in the song or certain moments in the live show. And that's always been interesting to us. I love all of them. I always say festival season is better than Christmas season, you know?
Wow. Yeah, you see almost that energy. In rock. You see the afternoon, these fans, they come at 11, like RJ said, at noon, and they're with you for 12 hours. Mm-hmm. They bring it too. They give it their all. And the energy for a 2 o'clock band is just as intense sometimes as a band at 8 or 9 o'clock.
I got to say, as a fan of this documentary, I really love the fact that you guys pointed that out and you really took it from the perspective of the fan, because that's literally why we wrote the song Freak Like Me, because these people are literally freaks to be sleeping in the mud and for like 4 days straight and then going out, standing on the barricade to see their favorite band for like 10 hours without any food, without any, and I'm just like, these people are superhuman. And I think that has something to do with the fact that we have this natural type of tribalism. It's probably a human nature trait. But this is a way that tribalism is actually a good thing. It actually results in a positive thing. These people find their sense of community, their sense of home, but it's in a positive, uplifting type of way. And I think if you're going to get latched on to anything, getting latched onto a type of music or a type of, or, you know, going out to see live shows. I think that's a really good thing. I'm on the train that's pulling the sick and twisted, making the most of the ride before we get arrested. We're all wasted and we're not going home tonight. Covered in black, we lack the social graces. Just like an animal, we crawl out of our cages. They can't tame us, so if you're one of us, get on the bus. If you're a freak like me, wave your flag. If you're a freak like me, get off your ass. It's our time now to let it all hang out. So shine.
There's also, you know, we talk about the Kevin, the psychologist in the movie, the adolescent, teen psychologist talks about the study that was done in Australia. Basically how this music can basically bind people together, and, you know, kids who used to get bullied, once they find their tribe, literally is the term used, they are now, the bullies are now afraid of them, and it empowers these kids, and maybe they put on a Metallica t-shirt, or maybe they get a piercing, and maybe they let their hair grow, but it's all part of being on that team. If that team's looking like that, then you're probably going to want to look like that. And it's kind of an interesting psychological deep dive into, you know, why this is like that. And I think Jerry Cantrell has a great quote about the tribalism, the tribal nature of it. And Dr. Drew also covers it in the film. And I think that, you know, it's that's what the movie is. And then back to the fans for a second, you know, Gary got us the party crew. And then we'd go back and we'd see this footage. And I was like, wait, is that a woman crowd surfing on top of her husband or a guy? And I was like, how do I get to know these people? And I call up Scott, who was the correction officer from the party crew. I was like, oh, he's like, yeah, that's Michelle. She's from New Orleans. I'll connect you with her. And I'm like, okay, great. And then there's, wait, who's that one-legged girl in the wheelchair? Mm-hmm. And he's like, oh,
she was the
Abby.
Star of the film. Abby, right?
Abby's the star of the film. And I'm like, get me Abby. So I go to Abby's trailer, Gallatin, Tennessee, and it's one of the greatest moments, interviews of my life, you know, to be able to sit down with someone like this. And she tells me, yeah, you know, I lost my fiance in a motorcycle crash where I lost my leg. And then once I got better, I went to the tattoo shop and there was this Harley out front. And then this guy, whose Harley it was, we fell in love and now we're together and we have another kid. I'm like, wow, I couldn't write this stuff if I was writing the script. So real, much why is reality TV so big? Because some of it is so captivating and real that you can't write it. And that's part of one of the things why the movie works, because some of these people are just so fantastic and so passionate about this genre that we were able to capture it, memorialize it. And the timing of it, obviously right before, put it together before it all shut down. And now we have this incredibly captive, frustrated audience that they can't go rock. And so we're the closest thing to being there, which is why we're putting it out now.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the surprise guests that was in this film is John Kasich, who apparently is a Metallica fan. I think I read he got kicked out of a Grateful Dead show. So he's been there.
He did work for Nixon. He actually wrote his letter to Nixon back in the day to get into politics. And he started up and he's on that team, but he is a great voice, and watching him rip apart Trump on CNN over the last couple of months has been a blessing, because one of the only Republican voices with sanity. And he, you know, it was really a touch and go thing to get him. And Gary can talk about getting that interview. I was like, Gary, we got to get John Kasich. Like, John Kasich's coming to the fucking show. We got to get him. So Gary can talk about that, because I love having him.
He's a real music fan, like legit rock fan. He loves the band Live. He loved the Chili Peppers. And that's why he did it. That's why he wanted, because it was a music documentary and it was about rock. So he had teenagers who came early to the Columbus Festival so they could see the side stage acts. And one band they were really into was Miss May I.
Oh, I love those guys. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, there's John Kasich, side of stage, you know, in the parking lot watching Miss May I with his kids.
What you don't expect, man. That's the cool thing about the rock fans, though, is that they're fans of the genre and these bands at the most pure form. They're purely just fans because they love it. They're not fans because it's trendy, because rock music is not like the trendy thing to do, you know? So it's genuine.
I also like seeing the corrections office. Was it a warden and the Gilkey? Is that the prisoner?
Yeah, the correction officer was a great story, because Scott was one of the main party crew guys. And I said, hey, Scott, I want to, you know, come where you work. And he's like, okay, cool. And he goes, there's this other guy who was an inmate, and he would come in and come out. And then, you know, I'd see him out, and I'd see him at a festival. And I was like, I wasn't sure if the guy, you know, wanted to hit me or not, but he's like, hey, can I buy you a beer? And I just really, tell me more. And he tells me about Gilkey. And I was like, can we get Gilkey on the phone? And so I got Gilkey on the phone and talked to him. And I said, hey man, would you be up for coming to the place that you were incarcerated and talk? And he's like, well, I don't know, man, you know, I'm not doing that. And, you know, I'm not going to that place again. I was like, dude, just, you know, walk me through it. And it was really cathartic for him in a way to see where he's come from and talk about his family and how his family saved his life and how this music was his therapy. And guys like that can turn it around, get out of drugs and doing bad stuff. You know, it was really good. And the fact that those guys built up a friendship based on this going to festivals was amazing to me. So, yeah, I love that piece of the film also.
That's a great story.
What's the secret to capturing on stage performances or the energy of the audience? I mean, do you just point the camera or where?
I'm telling you, like, those festivals that Gary runs, I've been to a lot of fucking music shows in my life. But those hard rock festivals, man, those fans, like that whole thing with Seth talking about how he, you know, he was he captured how many fans came over the barricade and crowd surfing for one Five Finger song. It was like 250 people or something like that. And we have the footage to prove it. So I think that, you know, the energy's there. Like, these bands bring it. Like, Hailstorm, all these bands, Metallica. I mean, come on. These bands fucking rock. And not only that, they've been doing it for so long, so often, that they're so tight that it just shows. And the energy is infectious, and the fans feel it, and the fans give the energy back to AJ, and he can comment on that next. But this give and take of energy, if you will. And then, like you said, then there's security, right? And they're in the middle, you know, handling these people off, ending their ride. And it's like, and they're pouring water on people. They're spraying water because it gets really hot up front, and they get pressed to the barricade, and they're pulling people out and letting them go back to go to the bathroom so they don't have to fucking fight through that crowd. And it really struck me as this symbiotic thing that Gary and the DWP people are like the ringmasters of, and they got to make it safe and they got to make it great. Another thing that we didn't even cover in the film, sorry to diverge, is what Gary and his people had to do with the weather. Like, the weather is ridiculous there. Like, all of a sudden, these boomer storms are, like, off, you know, 20 minutes, half hour, hour from here. Then they have to make the call. Do we evacuate? Because if we don't and someone gets hit by lightning, it's a disaster. And if we do and nothing happens, no rain comes through or no storm comes through, then everybody ridicules them. And it's like that was a whole nother storyline that we couldn't get to because – it just, we had, that was like the same day Chris Cornell died. Gary had to evacuate the place once or twice. So it's in a microcosm. A festival is really interesting that there's so many different moving parts, so many different things, the band's energy, the fans' energy, the promoters, what they have to deal with, security. So I'm glad we got to capture most of it because there's a lot to it.
Gary, I'm guessing you're an adrenaline junkie.
Yeah, I love control chaos.
Gary's also a slamming drummer.
As long as that's brought up, and you posted a thing on the Left Sets letter about Fountains of Wayne, you are a honorary member of Fountains of Wayne. Can you tell me that story?
Yeah, that's my 15 minutes right there. The quick story of Fountains of Wayne was they were doing two radio shows, the HF Festival and the BCN River Rave, and the drummer, Brian, and I was working at Atlantic Records, got so loaded in D.C., and I don't want to bust him, but I believe he hooked up with like a lady friend.
What?
I bring the PD of WBCN Oedipus, a Hall of Fame program director, to the Fountains of Wayne bus to meet, so the band can meet Oedipus like a half hour before they're supposed to go on. And I bring them up. Hey guys, this is Oedipus from BCN, and thanks so much for being part of River Rave. And Adam comes to me and goes, we got a little problem. I'm like, what's up? He's like, we don't have our drummer here. And Chris, the lead singer, kind of blurts out, yeah, I think we'll go acoustic today. And Oedipus goes, the fuck you will. And I go, here's my shot. I go, because Adam knew that I played too.
Yeah.
I go, guys, I could do it.
Chris, that's a total Keith Moon moment right there. He's like, I can play a lot better than him. Give me a shot.
Mountain Wayne's like pocket 4/4, and I know the songs because I adore the band.
Yeah.
And I could do this. It's just, just serve the song, right, RJ? So Chris was like, Chris said in front of Oedipus, is like, the record guy playing drums because they're kind of indie darlings, that's not cool, man. And Oedipus goes, guys, figure it out. Mm-hmm. And he walked off. And Chris was like, all right, you could play. And Adam's like, yeah, Gary could play. So I did they put on Red Dragon Tattoo in the bus and I air drummed it for them at the audition.
Air drummed it.
Oh my God.
I've never even heard this story, by the way.
And they're like, all right, let's go for it. Fuck it. So I get up on stage with them and they had a written out set list back in the day, with black Sharpie, and it's right there. And I know every song and I'm rocking, and it's like 5,000 people, side stage. People are like jumping and moshing. I'm like, God, the drummer's doing that.
Mm-hmm.
When it's moshing, that's the drummer's.
Right.
So I think it was during Sink to the Bottom or something. And I'm like rocking out and I'm like, this is happening. And Adam, bass player, does the move, that drummer acknowledgement move.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, he's going to eye contact me. And he turns around and he goes, slow the fuck down.
Oh, you were raking it, huh?
I was speeding a little bit because the adrenaline.
The adrenaline, yeah.
I have a cassette of it, and there's no YouTube. There's no nothing. I have one photo and a cassette tape of the performance.
That is such an amazing story, though. I hope that one goes in your book.
It will.
That's one for the book.
But, if it's not posted on social media, then did it really happen?
It really happened, right?
But you're exactly right. That's the energy that we get at those festivals, especially when we do those festivals that Gary puts on, the energy is incredible and the tempo can go straight through the roof. And we don't play to a click or we don't have any tracks or anything. Like we're as raw as it gets. So it's a lot of pressure on me to keep the tempo together. I'm sure that every drummer understands that.
Mm. Yeah. Thanks for letting me share that.
Of course.
That's an amazing story.
Yeah.
What a cool story, man.
You could retire now and you'll have that.
For the book.
I was backstage after, like an hour or so later, and there was Ed Kowalczyk of Live and Mark McGrath of Sugar Ray, and I knew them both. And this reporter comes up to us and it's kind of staring at me, and I step aside like, oh, she wants to, she's like, did you play drums with Fountains of Wayne? I'm like, yeah. She's like, can I interview you? Like, oh man, this is really embarrassing.
Rockstar. Well, welcome to the rockstar.
Rockstar for a day, man. It's fucking fantastic.
Yeah, it's like living the dream.
I really want to hear this tape. That's right.
Try to find it.
You got to put that out.
Nice.
Okay, so let me ask you, just as an aside and as a fan, because you mentioned Live and you mentioned Ed Kowalczyk, do you have more material? They're pretty much my all-time favorite band. Did you have more material with them? And have you, I know they didn't play, but you had a snippet with Ed.
Is that going on the Blu-ray?
Soundbite with Ed. we did a great interview with Ed. And he was, like I said, he and Kasich have a relationship. And we talked a little bit about that. And look, we have enough for another movie.
Mm-hmm.
We have so much material.
Sequel?
Stuff we shot, we shot like 5-6 cameras some days. And, when we got Michelle crowd surfing on top of her husband, she had a GoPro, he had a GoPro, we had a camera on stage, we had a camera in the crowd, we had a camera up above. And so we could shoot that crowd surfing moment. Cause to me, I really wanted that. And one last thing I'll tell about her is when I found her in the crowd, Scott got me her number. I reached her on the phone. I was like, hey, I'd like to interview you. she's like, I'll tell you what, I'm happy to do an interview if you can help me do a hamster ball fight with my husband to Godsmack's Crying Like a Bitch. And I was like, wait, you're negotiating with me? She's right. Like, yeah, I really want to do that. And I'm like, Gary, can we do this? And he's like, yeah, you know, not really. It's a security thing. I said, well, we interviewed security once. We have a tiny bit of relationship with him. Can I go to them and say, hey, as a filmmaker, would you just like look the other way for a couple minutes and let these balls roll into the crowd? Because that's all, once that happens, once the balls come down, it's over. And it was so good. We shot the shit out of that. And that was our end of the film. You know, that was our culmination of the film, because what better moment is there than to do that?
Right.
So it's just, it's funny how one experience begets another, and one person, you know, comes up with something that makes your movie fantastic. So it was really a great collaborative effort, team effort, to be able to do that. As a matter of fact, I had my kids' graduation from college that weekend, I think, and Gary had to direct that thing as well as doing a festival. Oh. He had to do that scene.
Controlled chaos, more of it. That's what he lives on.
Yeah, he's an adrenaline junkie. And, the other thing I'll say about him is that the day Cornell dies and they have to evacuate, I'm thinking to myself, okay, my producer, he's gone. I'm not going to see this guy at all today, because he's got his hands full a little bit, and he's dealing with the National Weather Service and the state and the local government and trying to find a headliner, and he, you know, didn't drop any balls. It was an amazing character to be able to be in business with. So, fun project to work on, shall we say.
No, but I thank you guys for supporting
this
love letter to rock and roll. And I hope everybody watching could download it and experience it. Like McHugh said, there are no live shows right now. Maybe this is a great way to help ease that pain. Go, you know, turn it up in your home theater system and enjoy Long Live Rock.
It's available now, and you can the website is longliverockmovie.com, and you can find it there. I think if you probably go on Amazon, or where can they find it?
On the 12th, it'll be available. Just go through the website, and you can pick theaters. You know, like if you want to support certain theaters in your area, you can go through them to watch the movie, and that's called Virtual Cinema Live. Nice. And then, you know, that'll run for a couple months, and then we'll go up to different streaming platforms like Amazon and iTunes and maybe others. That's all being put together right now. But for right now, we wanted to go directly to the fans to be able to just watch it and also support theaters, because virtual cinemas, you know, that's like another lost art. You know, going to the movies is something you haven't done in a year, and it's tragic. Yeah. 'Cause I just love that aspect of, you know, much like a live concert when the lights go down and you're commuting with, you're not really commuting with other people like in the theater, but it is, there's something special about both the live concert and the movie theaters that are just left us behind right now, you know?
I think especially right now, though, this movie is like concert porn, you know, for people who really miss going. They're like, oh, you want to watch Long Live Rock tonight? Yeah, baby, let's watch it.
Let us hope, man.
Yes, that's what it's like.
Put that in the, put it in your stand-up act now, that little bit. You got, yeah.
It's a very good point. It's a good point, because if these are your favorite bands, then you're going to, you know, absorb every moment and rewatch, hopefully.
Yeah.
I mean, when you look at the list, and I had to send a list out to somebody the other day, and I was like, wow, you have 50 of the top rock stars in this genre interviewed in this film. And then the many more that didn't make it just because of time or whatever. Mm-hmm. So you look back at the culmination of the work and how many bands are performing. I think we have 16 songs in the film, performance songs or pieces of music. And, you know, I think we did a nice job of trying to blend it all together and give people, like AJ said, that bit of experience from it and get to know some people and get to know some of the bands a little bit better too.
It's phenomenal. It's been a while. So it was kind of cathartic to see that and you got some great footage just to kind of capture those moments. So it's really worth checking out. I really recommend it.
Thanks for having me in it, man.
Yeah, AJ, thank you for your contribution. It's great.
Oh, absolutely. I'm so honored to be a part of it.
Long Live Rock. Celebrate the chaos. Ah!
Yeah.
Spectacular.
That's awesome. Thank you.
Yeah. I love this movie, and I love talking with these guys. Wasn't this was great.
This film really... gave us the sense of community. And really, this community, this rock community, I mean, we have our music that we, you know, the festivals that we've attended, but this is the hard rock community. And it is really, you got the sense of community from watching the film. They did some great interviews, talked to some of the fans in depth and other associated people. And I hope our listeners will go see this film because it was really fun. It was a lot of fun to watch. And it gave you a great inside knowledge and better understanding of these people who follow, you know, follow these bands and the festivals.
Yeah, it's worth checking out. Again, go to longliverockmovie.com to find out all the details on where you can see this movie right now. Highly recommend that you check it out.
And you get the movie aspect of it where you get some behind the scenes stuff. We got to meet, it was fun seeing meeting the security people and hearing some of their stories and the fans, and we highly recommend this movie.
Yeah. So thanks to Gary Spivak, Jonathan McHugh, and RJ Hale. We hope to see them again further down the road in a festival setting. If you want to know anything else, we'll be posting on our website and information on our social media pages. Where can you find us, Holly?
You can find us on Facebook at What Difference Does It Make Podcast. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at WDDIM Podcast. And you can also find a lot of stuff and a lot of outtakes and behind the scenes stuff on our YouTube page. So just search for What Difference Does It Make Podcast.
Much like what we talked about with the director, where there is just so much footage that he could have made another film. I think we talked with these guys so long, we could make a whole other YouTube podcast on our talk today.
So check out our deleted scenes.
We're going to end our podcast with the Satellite City song, Getaway. Okay, so until next time, this is Dave.
This is Holly.
Check you later.
Over and out.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.